Can I add my thanks to Sir Mark and Professor Ski for agreeing to debate with us today? As Macaulay said, men are never so likely to settle a question rightly as when they discuss it freely. But sadly, in this sphere, the principal advocates of global warming alarmism, like Al Gore and Michael Mann, refuse absolutely to debate with us sceptics. They believe we must be denied a platform, apparently in the fear that even if one of us is allowed publicly to be heard, it will have the same effect as the little boy who shouted out that the emperor has no clothes. All credit to Sir Mark and Professor Ski for having greater confidence in their case than some other proponents of this matter, who also have rather fewer scientific credentials than they do. First, my credentials. Can I say where I come from on this issue? I have a degree in natural sciences, mainly physics, from Cambridge, so I don't dispute the science of global warming. I then turned to economics, and it was actually the economics which initially aroused my doubts about climate change policy. My first vocation was as a development economist working in developing countries, and indeed my principal worries about the impact of prematurely decarbonising the world economy is the effect it would have on the poorest countries and indeed in the poor in our own country. I then became an investment analyst specialising in the oil and energy industries, and I retain an interest as a director of an exploration company operating exclusively in Central Asia and with no interest in UK policy. I began to be sceptical about the case for a crash programme to decarbonise the British economy when the climate change bill was going through Parliament. When government introduces a bill, they have to produce an impact assessment, a cost-benefit analysis of the measures they're introducing to show, to demonstrate to Parliament that the costs are less than the benefits. I went to get a copy of the impact assessment. I was the only person in Parliament to do so. I know that because the vote office, which hands it out, said no one else had asked for a copy. I read it. It was an amazing document. It said that the potential cost of the Climate Change Act, excluding the cost of driving our industry overseas and the transition costs of up to 1% of GDP for 20 years, excluding that, was twice the maximum benefits to the world from the reduction in global warming that the Climate Change Act was intended to bring about. Now, maybe there was an alternative strategy for tackling global warming, which would have had positive net benefits. Maybe the impact assessment was questionable. But as it stood, no rational person could support the Act. Yet only five of us voted against it. At no stage during the passage of the bill could any of its supporters be persuaded even to discuss the cost of this measure. And that's why I concluded that on the issue of climate change, the political class had collectively set reason aside. Instead, it sees this as a field in which they must compete to demonstrate their moral superiority by outbidding each other in imposing burdens on the British public. My doubts, as I said, have been on the economics, but as the vote was taken on the Climate Change Act, it began to snow outside. So I asked the House to ponder the fact we were passing a bill based on the premise that the world was getting warmer when it was snowing in October in London for the first time in 74 years. Immediately the sneer went up from the other side. Lily doesn't even realise that extreme cold is a symptom of global warming. Well, I hadn't. Then I realised that many of the alarmists have not the first idea about science. If both cold and warmth are symptoms of global warming, how could this thesis possibly be refuted? And as Karl Popper explained, if a statement can't be refuted, it's not science. Now, although we ridicule non-science, we do not doubt the actual science of global warming. But we do have concerns about the climate models. To be more precise, the facts cast doubt on the validity of the models. This chart shows the wide range of projections from the models, 50 or more models, followed by the IPCC. However, the two lines at the bottom are different measures of what actually happened to temperatures. In normal science, we'd simply discard all the models that proved wrong. A couple of them proved broadly right. But that's not how it works in the democratic world of the United Nations, where all models are equal. And so the official IPCC forecast is the average of 50 models, 48 of which are wrong. This, to me, is postmodern science, to believe models rather than believe reality. I prefer to stick by the scientific method described by Richard Feynman, who said, first we spell out the consequences of our theory, then we compare the result of the computation directly with observation to see if it works. If it disagrees, it is wrong. In that simple statement is the key to science. It does not make any difference how beautiful your theory is. It does not make any difference how smart you are, who made the theory or model, I add, or what his name is. If it disagrees with experiment, it is wrong. That is all there is to it. End of quote. Now, modelers won't accept that. They say their models can't be wrong because they're derived from the laws of physics. Of course, that's only partly true. Models also incorporate countless parametrizations to deal with phenomena like clouds, which cannot be reduced to simple physical laws as yet. The modelers plead that where observations deviate from predictions, that's due to unspecified natural variations, although that would apply that much of the warming observed since 1975 could also be due to natural variations in the opposite direction. The Royal Society recently dispatched two of its top climate scientists, I believe one of them is present here today, to Parliament, as missionaries among the unbelievers, to convince us that despite the pause, global warming is every bit as bad as previously predicted, and we must believe the models for the future. One of my colleagues, not actually a sceptic, kept asking, how long would the pause have to continue before you begin to doubt the models? To our amazement, Professor Palmer replied, 50 years. In short, we shall not be able to falsify these models in our lifetime. Well, some of you will, but some of us won't. I remember learning about the German philosopher Professor Hegel, who claimed rather similarly that he could deduce the whole laws of natural science from his first principles. And when his disciples came back and said, but master, the facts disagree with your theories, he replied, so much the worse for the facts. Well, to me, the facts are sovereign. And if the facts say one thing and the models are the other, the models need changing. A recent peer-reviewed study, however, shows that over the recent decades, the models have changed. They move closer to each other, but further away from the facts. They seem to put conformity before accuracy. And Dick Linson gave an explanation of this in his memorable IKEA lecture last week when he said, for the advocates of policies allegedly addressing global warming, the role of models is not to predict, but rather to justify the claim that catastrophe is possible. As they understand, proving something is impossible is itself almost impossible. I'll return to predictions of catastrophe, but first let me address my principal concern, which is the impact of decarbonisation policy on the poor and the poorest countries. Poor countries, we can all agree, have contributed least to carbon emissions. We can also agree they're the most vulnerable to climate change, whether that's for natural or man-made reasons. But they're vulnerable because they're poor. Indeed, because they're poor, they're vulnerable not just to weather extremes, which account for a minuscule 0.06% of deaths, but to all sorts of disease and disaster. And they'll only cease to be vulnerable as they develop. Now comes a test. As this chart shows, mortality from weather-related extremes, global warming notwithstanding, has diminished dramatically and steadily as the world has developed over the last century. But development is almost synonymous with harnessing energy. And the speed with which poor countries can replace human brawn by energy depends on the cost of energy. If they're bullied or persuaded to rely on new renewables which cost two or three times as much as fossil fuels, they'll only be able to afford a half or a third as much energy. So they'd be condemned to suffer for another couple of generations the ills of poverty which cause 99% of premature mortality in the hope of avoiding a possible increase in weather-related disasters which cause a fraction of 1%, might increase several-fold but still be small over the longer term. Moreover, on Lord Stern's worst case projections, which illustrates as follows, if the world does nothing to restrict the use of fossil fuels The average income of people in the developing country, after subtracting the highest losses due to global warming, will be over six times as high as it is at present by the year 2100, and 20 times as high by the year 2200. So this generation and their children in poor countries must be made to suffer prolonged poverty in order that their incomparably richer descendants do not have to spend so much on air conditioning and flood defence. Developing countries know this. That's why India last week declared Greenpeace a threat to national development, because it promotes and incites opposition to nuclear, coal and other power stations. But the environment movement is apparently unmoved by their concerns and tries to stifle them. So last week, Professor Rossiter had his fellowship at the Institute for Policy Studies terminated for writing an article against, the headline of the article was "Sacrificing Africa for Climate Change, Western Policies Seem More Interested in Carbon Dioxide Levels Than in Life Expectancy." It seems from his dismissal that environmentalists are prepared to sacrifice Africa and Asia, come to that, at the altar of climate change. The world cannot prevent CO2 concentration from doubling without constraining the developing world's use of fossil fuels. The bulk of emissions growth will come from non-OECD countries in future. The annual increase in Chinese emissions alone in recent years exceeds the entire emissions from the UK in a year. So if we decarbonise entirely, we offset 1 year of China's growth. But we can only decarbonise once. And that's why Lord Stern, Deeman and others go to such lengths to convince us that really China, prompted by Britain's self-sacrifice, is switching massively to renewables and will soon be cutting emissions. This is not the view of most observers. This, I think, comes from Deutsche Bank, but based on BP's figures. At present, renewables in China account for just 1% of China's primary energy. A clearer idea of how their current energy use is made up. Even by 2020, wind is forecast to supply only 5% of electricity, which of course itself is only part of their total energy use, rising, according to the International Energy Agency, to 8.4% of electricity by 2030, and then double that, about 17%, by 2050. Solar, however, is trivial. It's less than a half of 1%. By 2020. China's use of fossil fuels will eventually peak, the sooner the better, because of the particulates it spews out, but it won't be due to renewables, and it is not imminent. And after China will come India and Africa. So our attempts are puny in comparison and virtually irrelevant. Now, the claim for decarbonising the world's economy used to rely on the assertion that the science of global warming is certain, and as a result, we can calculate, as Lord Stern purported to do, the costs of doing nothing versus the cost of decarbonising. That position has now been abandoned by everyone except the UK government and opposition parties, both of whom still rely on Stern's report to justify their position. Everybody else, including Lord Stern himself, however, now stands the initial proposition on its head. They say the science is so uncertain that we cannot rule out that global warming might be off the scale, and the impacts just conceivably could lead to an unspecified catastrophe threatening the end of the human race. So on the precautionary principle, we should insure against it, against the albeit remote possibility of apocalypse sometime. Now, if I believe that there was a finite chance of global warming leading ineluctably and irreversibly to the extinction or immiseration of the human race, I would not be fussed about discount rates and so on. I entirely agree with Mark there. I'd support the most ardent measures to prevent that occurring. But I know of no credible peer-reviewed study which suggests even a temperature increase well above the 4 degrees centigrade with which alarmists threaten us would lead to extinction or immiseration of humankind. Problems, certainly, but problems which might well be less than the cost of trying to avoid them. Mankind has, after all, adapted to different climates, from the Arctic Circle to the tropics, a difference of nearer 50 degrees than 5 degrees centigrade. And extreme climates are not the result of higher temperatures, If that were the case, cold places would not have extreme climates. The Antarctic would be calm and storm-free. Well, tell that to Captain Scott. Heat can only be converted into mechanical energy as a result of temperature differences. It's temperature gradients that matter, and the overall impact of global warming is forecast to reduce temperature gradients across the world as the cold poles warm most and the already hot tropics warm least. The worst catastrophe that would result from global warming would be the melting of the ice caps. But because melting requires considerable latent heat, according to the IPCC, this will take millennia to occur. Now, given a few centuries, let alone a millennium, I cannot believe that humanity, which is wonderfully resourceful and adaptable, will not find a way of avoiding that or any catastrophe, especially as it would have to be signalled in advance by a very obvious acceleration in warming after the current pause, way beyond anything we saw during the 1980s. All the recent empirical studies suggest, however, that in fact global warming will be far lower than the models are programmed to predict. But shock tactics are all that are left to justify the painful policies on which we are embarked. So I wasn't surprised that Sir Mark talked about the price of his grandchild. His grandchild is going to be several times better off than any of us in this room, and his grandchildren's grandchildren will be better off still, even on the sort of worst-case assumptions that Lord Stern used to spell out. And when he talks about us being inside the house on fire, that is simply rhetoric. It is not science. So what should we do? Well, very briefly, of course we should support cost-effective measures to increase energy efficiency. We should encourage research and development to develop forms of energy and energy storage that are cheaper than and as reliable as fossil fuels. We should develop shale gas. We shouldn't invest, except on a pilot basis, in immature technologies like wind. We should abandon support for biofuels, which will reduce by displacement the yield of food more than global warming is predicted to do so, again in the Stern report. We should accept that developing countries need to develop the cheapest energy sources available and not discourage or prevent them from doing so. But if we do retain incentives to reduce carbon emissions, we should ramp them up gradually as global warming actually occurs and indexed to that global warming, as suggested by Professor McKittrick. Then if those who take an alarmist view are right, the tax on carbon would have to go up rapidly. If I'm right, it would languish at a low level.